Yesterday marked the 10th anniversary of the mapping of the human genome, a scientific milestone that's been compared to putting a man on the moon. Today, in a sign of how far we've traveled over the last decade, the Supreme Court is poised to decide whether human genes can be patented. We're joined now by Dr. Robert Klitzman, a professor of clinical psychiatry, director of the Masters of Bioethics program at Columbia University, and author of Am I My Genes? It is published by Oxford University Press. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you.
Mapping the human genome was a huge undertaking, but when it was completed, weren't researchers essentially left with a lot of information they didn't know how to read or interpret?
Yes, that's a wonderful point. The fact is that the human genome remains far more complicated than anyone had thought. So what happened 10 years ago was we mapped the 3 billion letters that made us. At the time, scientists thought that about half of it was, quote, junk DNA. We've since found out, of course, that it's not junk.
That every one of these genes has some kind of function. Now, we have fewer genes than rice, don't we?
Yes, that's right.
So does that mean rice is a more complex thing than the humans?
Well, I prefer to think that we're better designed, though rice might disagree with that. We have about 20,000 genes, which is about the same as mice, and rice has 46,000 genes, and people are still trying to figure out why there's such a vast difference. My sense is that our genes are in some ways more intelligent. That is, we have an immune system that can figure out how to design a defense against each virus using the same parts rather than having a unique mechanism for each potential virus, for instance.
So as evolution has gone along, we become more efficient?
Well, we hope so. Of course, there's no one hand, many of us think, that's guiding all this, so it's all chance and error. For some reason, we have been able to use the same building blocks that mice have, basically, to erect ourselves.
Well, some of those, that junk DNA, what we thought was junk DNA, it doesn't do good things, right? I mean, not all of the things in our genome have positive aspects.
Yes, that's right. So our DNA is a history of everything that we have faced genetically that we've had to deal with. Sometimes different bacteria and viruses can insert their genes into our genome.
So they become part of the human genome?
Exactly right.
Something that perhaps a prehistoric person suffered from, now we all have in our bodies?
Yes. It turns out that viruses can take bits of pieces of other DNA from other species and insert it into ours. So it's a very complicated process, much more complicated than anyone thought.
Has the Human Genome Project lived up to the predictions that were made about it?
Well, it's a very good question. In some ways, it was able to achieve the full mapping of the human genome much sooner than anyone had predicted, and the price has gone down dramatically. But I sort of think an analogy would be if you were to speak to Christopher Columbus in 1492, and he said, you know, I found these islands off the coast of India. It would take 200-300 years to figure out exactly the fact that he had, in fact, discovered whole continents. So we know what DNA is. It was actually 60 years ago this year that Watson and Crick first discovered it. We've mapped the human genome, but it turns out to be much more complicated than anyone had thought.
But so do we know how many diseases are now linked to genes or specific mutations of genes?
Well, there's probably about 5,000 diseases that are linked to specific genes. The problem is that predicting disease is a little bit like predicting the weather. So sometimes I can tell you there's a 100% chance that it's going to rain tomorrow, but often the weather report is that there's a 30% chance of rain or a 40% chance of rain. And you'd think that that would be easier because whatever the weather is in Philadelphia today is what we're going to have here in New York tomorrow.
Can we predict that there'll always be mutations?
Well, we each have about mutations for about 6 lethal diseases in us. Of course, they may not express themselves, and there are environmental factors that can influence whether genes express themselves as well. And genes, the human genome, has evolved an ability to correct certain errors. So a single error may not kill you, but if you have a few errors or if you have particularly bad errors, they can be lethal.
But so what happens is we actually fight against a weird mutation.
Yes. So actually our ancestors.
Or we correct it.
Right. Exactly. So there may be, for instance, 2 or 3 genes that could make certain things in our body. So if one isn't working, the others can fill in.
Has mapping the human genome and understanding which mutations on which genes cause which diseases produced advances that can be seen in my GP's office?
Well, the hope is that that will soon be the case, and we're beginning to do that. So, for instance, we can now find for particular medications, for particular diseases, which medication will work best for you as opposed to me, and at which dose. That is, which dose will work better for you rather than for me. And there are certain diseases, particularly certain kinds of cancers, a certain kind of colon cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, where we have pretty good predictive ability, though not 100%, and that can help doctors increase screening. But for common diseases like heart disease, diabetes, depression, there are probably many genes involved. So it's a little more complicated.
So it's interactions of genes.
Yes.
Would that also apply to when we hear about things like the gay gene or the IQ gene? Would it really would that be inaccurate? Would we really be talking about the interactions of a number of genes or many genes?
Yes. So intelligence, for instance, is estimated to be about 50% inheritable. But we don't have a gene that is the intelligence gene, even though you see headlines sometimes saying the IQ gene, the gay gene, the fat gene, the addiction gene, etc.
My guess is Robert L. Klitzman. His book, Am I My Genes, is published by Oxford University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But there are certain diseases, you've been saying, that are linked to very specific genes. And at the center of the Supreme Court case today is a company called Myriad Genetics, which holds patents on two genes that, when mutated, increase the likelihood a woman will develop breast or ovarian cancer. Why does the company claim it owns a patent on these genes?
Well, these are very important issues and great questions. The story is that the company, Myriad Genetics, discovered that these two bits of DNA encoded the genes that, if mutated, as you say, can cause breast cancer.
And they're the ones who discovered it, not some scientist working in some lab at a university.
Correct. Well, I think they actually were scientists working in a lab at a university, but they then patented it. They claim that this discovery is a novel one and that it's not obvious, and therefore they have the ability to patent it. And the patent office said, okay. Obviously, there are many of us who think that raises many questions.
Is Myriad's testing business for these two genes particularly lucrative?
It's incredibly lucrative. So Myriad earns hundreds of millions of dollars. I think they earned $500 million last year. And the problem is that if I'm a woman at risk of breast cancer, I have to pay, or my insurance has to pay, $3,000 to $4,000 to have this test done. The test might only, in fact, cost $100 to run, and the difference goes to as profit to the company. And as a result, many women can't afford it.
So they've patented it. They could easily charge $100,000 for the test.
Exactly.
Because they own it. Is this unique to these two genes, or are there other genes that have been patented?
There are many, many genes, thousands of genes that have been patented. It's estimated that around 20% of the 20,000 or so human genes have been patented, which means a company owns it. And of course, this means they will claim that they own the idea and not the gene itself, but the process by which one isolates it. But many people say that what's important is the information in the gene, which is in fact part of our human nature and therefore is part of all humanity.
Were Henrietta Lacks's genes patented?
I don't think her genes were patented.
The big issue there is more a matter of privacy.
Yes, and also her cells from her cancer, which scientists were able to have reproduce in petri dishes for the first time. No human cells had been reproduced in petri dishes, and she got none of the profit, even though scientists and companies earned hundreds of millions of dollars off it.
Well, in the case of the Myriad genes, are the people who supplied the genes getting any money?
Presumably not.
So what's the big difference here?
Well, I think the issue here is that there are public health concerns beyond just whoever happened to donate the genes for that led to Myriad being able to isolate those genes. In this case, if I'm a woman at risk of breast cancer and I don't have health insurance, I may not be able to afford to get tested for it. And there's a question, should companies be allowed to patent what is in fact part of all of our natures.
How long can someone hold a patent on a particular gene before it goes into the public domain? Is this like developing any other drug where at a certain point some company in India is going to be making a generic version?
Yes. So obviously patents raise a number of questions in terms of how much they're respected in other countries. And the problem is that the our ability to sequence the whole genome has dropped precipitously. So 10 years ago, it cost about $100 million to sequence the first person's whole genome. There are 3 billion letters. Now it costs around $1,000. And many people are starting to have this done.
So if I was worried about having breast cancer, if I were a woman worried about having breast cancer, couldn't I just have that test done and go around Myriad?
If you want that test, and this is why this is all going to the courts, is that this is increasingly going to be an issue that needs to be worked out in hospitals and doctors' offices. Up till now, most people said, I want to be tested for this particular gene. Now that we can sequence all your genes, there are questions. Will Myriad charge money for sequencing, for determining that in that sequence you have the breast cancer gene? In other words, how far should a patent go? And this court is actually looking at whether or not this is even patentable in the first place, whether the patent should have been given.
Is our increased understanding of DNA being treated like other technological advances, like when a company develops new software? I mean, is this kind of – can a human gene actually be invented the same way that Microsoft Word was invented?
Well, these are great points. So according to patent law, you can't patent a law of nature. I can't patent equals MC squared or Boyle's law or various laws in chemistry.
Too bad for Einstein.
Too bad for Einstein. He would have made – been a very wealthy man. So the question is, what is being patented? And the decision before the Supreme Court is – whether or not what is isolated, what the Myriad is isolated, whether that is unique and different from what is in the human genome. And it's sort of like saying if I have figured out a way to take my liver out, and here's a liver isolated, is that separate from the liver inside me? And one could say that if I know that if I clip the human genome right here and pull it out in a certain way, that process is what they say they're patenting, that they figured out where to clip it. And again, this gets into some technical details, but I think the broader principle is that genes are part of all of us. Companies will say that they want to promote innovation, that only by allowing for patents and intellectual property rights will companies be incentivized to do this research. Many of us would argue, on the other hand, that the Human Genome Project was paid for by our tax dollars and is there to help all of us. It may be that certain things may be patentable, but whether or not one should be able to patent all human genes and charge as much as one wants, I think, is another question.
Well, getting back to your analogy with the liver or a kidney, as others have suggested, that isolated from the body, they would be patentable. Well, I could die of some liver disease, and they take my liver out. Couldn't they then patent what they find there?
Someone will make a lot of money off you. I would argue that that just simply cutting something out is not does not mean that what is then cut out is sufficiently different from the way it is in the body. And that gets to be the crux of the matter here. You can think of various analogies. And I think the issue is that there undoubtedly is something slightly different about the isolated bit of genes. They probably tweak the end to make it split right there. But that's different from – but the information certainly is the same.
Well, you obviously have a position on this, and a lot of other people. The New York Times editorial today takes a similar position. What about other bioethicists? Do they all tend to agree on this matter?
I think people are split for a few reasons. On the one hand, one wants to encourage innovation. So there are people who think that companies should be incentivized. If we didn't allow patents – we wouldn't have cell phones because we wouldn't have Google or Microsoft, et cetera. I think the question is, or there are several questions. One is how long a patent should be given for, what the criteria should be. I think there needs to be more rigorous establishment of those criteria, et cetera.
Now, Myriad developed this very important test. Shouldn't they be able to profit from that?
I think arguably they should be able to profit some. The question is, can they profit as much as they want? I would argue that to charge $3,000 for a test that, let's say, costs $100 and thereby preventing millions of women from being able to undergo testing, that is a problem.
But we have the same kind of problem when we take an MRI, don't we?
Well, I thought you were going to say with various drugs, for
okay.
instance.
So
drugs.
I go to Europe and get a drug. In fact, I got some eye drug once because I had run out. And my pharmacist here said, you know, you got it for less than I pay on the wholesale level.
Right. So we know that drug pricing is also somewhat artificial, and we in the United States pay much more for certain drugs than people in India or Brazil or even several European countries. I think, though, what's important is that we have a broad conversation to decide, is this the kind of society we want to live in? Is this the kind of marketplace we want? And I think that's great that the Supreme Court is taking this issue up to raise these issues to see where we should draw the line and how these decisions should be made.
But you have no idea where the Supreme Court is going to come out on this.
My understanding is that under Bush, the Bushes as president, there was a sense that many things should be patented, and that the Supreme Court recently, for various reasons, is pushing back on that to some degree.
And hasn't the Obama administration also been pushing back? It broke a long-standing policy. The Patent and Trademark Office says in its brief that isolated genes should not be patentable. If the plaintiffs are victorious in this case, what's going to happen with the Obama administration's policies?
Well, I think that Obama is clearly on one side of this, his administration of this debate, and happens to be the side I'm on. But I think there'll be many questions that remain. I think this is not going to be settled completely by the Supreme Court's decision today, though I think – or the Supreme Court's hearing arguments today. But I think it will go an important way forward in helping us to understand how to deal with these issues as we move forward.
My guest is Robert L. Klitzman, professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the Masters of Bioethics program at Columbia University. He's the co-founder of Columbia University's Center of Bioethics. His latest book is Am I My Genes? Confronting Fate and Family Secrets in the Age of Genetic Testing. It's published by Oxford University Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Dr. Robert Klitzman. His book, Am I Genes? Confronting Fate and Family Secrets in the Age of Genetic Testing, published by Oxford University Press. In his State of the Union address, President Obama said that every dollar we invested in it to map the human genome returned $140 to the economy. Do we know how that figure was calculated?
I don't know. I think it's a wonderful thing that there has been public investment in science in this. I think that the more public investment in science, the better, and that it can very much improve our lives. But I don't know how that exactly was calculated. And I think, again, as we mentioned earlier, the issue is that the benefits from our mapping the human genome may not be obvious to us for years to come.
Well, let's say I get my genome mapped and it turns out that I carry a gene that's linked to a disease. That doesn't mean that there's a treatment for it.
Correct.
You might find Parkinson's, but right now we can't cure Parkinson's.
Correct. I think the notion, which I think is a wonderful idea, is that the more we understand about the cause of diseases, the more we'll be able to understand possible pathways for treating them and curing them. So if we can understand what genes go awry that lead to diseases such as Parkinson's, we can best figure out how to develop treatments that can target those processes and prevent damage.
Has science gotten far ahead of where the law is, and even where to a point where our lawmakers and our Supreme Court justices might not be able to understand what's going on?
Absolutely. I think a major problem is that the science has mushroomed in this area and other areas in the past 10 years, and our ability to understand and grapple with the ethical, legal, and social implications is far behind.
Are you concerned that members of Congress who don't believe in evolution will be voting on legislation in this area?
It's a major problem. If you look at the American public overall, I think about 40% of people believe in creationism rather than evolution. I think that there are school districts where creationism is still taught as a theory equivalent to evolution, despite vast amounts of scientific evidence to the contrary. I think that we need very much to increase scientific literacy in this country, and I think it's been underfunded, and that's a major problem.
Let's say I do have my genome mapped and discover that I have a predisposition to a certain genetic disease. Can that influence how I approach the rest of my life choices, perhaps not always in a positive way?
Well, it could be positive or negative. And I think of genetic information and our ability to map the genome as sort of being equivalent to our understanding of the atom. So once we understood how the atom worked, thanks to Einstein and other physicists, we could make nuclear power that was cheap, but people were also able to make nuclear bombs. And so we could use this information for good or bad.
But how do you counsel people who learn that they're genetically predisposed to a certain condition when little might be able to be done to deal with the problem?
Well, we increasingly do have a lot of ways of dealing with problems. And one interesting area in which that's the case is through reproductive technologies. So if I'm at risk of Huntington's disease, for instance, which is a lethal mutation, Woody Guthrie famously died of it, I may not be able to treat the Huntington's disease that I have, but I can screen embryos so to make sure that that lethal mutation does not pass on to my children and my grandchildren. And many people are doing this today.
You note that some parents may believe that a child is more likely to inherit a disease mutation if he or she physically resembles the parent with the mutation. That's not true, is it?
Yes, correct. I've seen many people, even scientists, believe that. People say, well, I look more like my mother, and she's the one who had Huntington's disease, so we always assumed I'd be the one to develop it. In fact, genetics is very complex, so I may inherit some things from my mother, some from my father. But we have myths about this that persist.
Can we do embryonic screening now?
Yes, very easily. We now can screen embryos for thousands of things. People are deciding, I only want a boy, and they're screening embryos for that. People are saying, I don't want my embryos to have the breast cancer mutation or the Huntington's mutation. We now have technologies where we can take blood from the arm of a pregnant woman and look at the whole genome of her fetus. So women may be able to say, I see that my fetus has a gene associated with, say, a 20% chance of autism. And women may say, I don't want to have that child. I want to have an abortion.
Although that's going to become less and less possible in many parts of the country.
Alas, about abortion, yes.
A listener wrote on our show page, I'm an adoptee and I'm interested in doing genetic testing, but have held off from doing so because I'm not sure how genetic testing will affect my health insurance coverage in the future. Could you talk about the current laws that enable one to protect your genetic information? Are there any such protections?
Yes, it's a great question. Discrimination is an ongoing concern. So there is the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act that Congress passed and was signed by the president in 2008, but it applies only to health insurance. It does not apply to disability insurance or long-term care insurance or life insurance. So for the listener who wrote in, technically your health insurance is protected, but if you then want to apply for life insurance, they can easily ask and often do, have you ever had genetic testing? What were the results? And they may make a decision based on that.
Can an employer screen you for these things?
The issue with employment is not that employers can screen. My understanding is they cannot. But that if you happen to tell your office mate, for instance, or a coworker that, you know, I just found out I have the breast cancer mutation, there have been instances where that then gets around in the office. You don't get fired. But patients have told me where everyone assumed that they would be promoted when the boss retired, and suddenly the boss retired and they were not promoted. And they can't say it's because word got around that I have the breast cancer mutation, but they're convinced that that's the reason. And human nature is being what it is, I think that caution is clearly needed.
So we're going to see a growing stigma about having certain genes.
I think so. And for instance, we now have, as I said, genes associated with autism. Not 100%, but if we find out, for instance, that little Johnny over there has that gene associated with the 20% chance of autism, the question is whether or not his or her parents may treat him differently, not read to him as much. If the teachers find out, will they not pay as much attention to Johnny, et cetera?
But it's interesting that autism often occurs in families where neither parent nor anybody in previous generations was autistic. So where does that genetic inheritance come from?
Well, it's a great point. So we know that for many complex behaviors and traits and complex diseases, such as autism, they're probably not just genetic factors, but environmental factors. And then we know that for each of us, there are de novo or new genetic mutations that occur. So you and I each have genetic mutations that our parents didn't have. And the reason is that every time those 3 billion letters are typed out, so to speak, some errors get made, some typos. Most of them mean nothing, but occasionally they can lead to autism or Alzheimer's or anything else.
In a recent op-ed, you wrote, quote, "The wealthy are eliminating certain diseases from their descendants while the poor cannot, widening the gap between the haves and the have-nots." What kinds of diseases are wealthy people now able to remove from their children?
Well, breast cancer is a good example. So the wealthy can increasingly say, I don't want my children to have breast cancer, and they're eliminating embryos that have those genes, whereas poor people cannot afford to do that. Down syndrome, for instance, is another one.
Well, we already have tests for that that even poor people take advantage of.
Yes, they do. But increasingly, we know that for certain kinds of mental retardation, that the kinds of screening that we do have done don't pick up all of the cases of mental retardation.
Are we seeing this happening right now?
Well, we know that people are screening out breast cancer. People are screening out Huntington's disease. People are screening out a number of other diseases. Most tend to be rare diseases, but this is happening.
This sounds like something out of Aldous Huxley.
Yes, it is. And there was the movie Gattaca a few years ago that took this to even further extents. And again, we're at the tip of the iceberg. We're sort of at a tipping point in which I think the decisions we make today about how we want to treat genetic information as a society, whether we want to allow people who can afford to do so to screen out diseases from their children, these are major decisions that we need to think about.
When the genome was mapped a decade ago, there were predictions of that we would be able to completely re-engineer our bodies if we wanted to. How far away are we from being able to do that, the designer genes that we've heard about?
Well, I think we're still a bit away from that. As I said, the genome turns out to be far more complicated than anyone thought. We've not been able to dramatically change our own genomes that much. In other words, even with screening embryos, the embryos are the ones that are produced by our own gametes, sperm, and eggs. And we can say we don't want to use certain ones and not insert certain ones into the woman, but we're limited by what we happen to have.
So we, as yet, cannot produce a higher IQ child or blonde, blue-eyed kids if we want.
Correct.
But is that a possibility somewhere down the line?
Yes.
It's because it's sounding scarier and scarier as we discuss this.
Well, the other issue that happens is there are three countries in the world that allow you to buy and sell human eggs. And those are India, Russia, and the United States. So people in this country are now buying human eggs online and elsewhere, and they're able to say, I want to have a child with blonde hair, blue eyes, so I'm going to use an egg donor who has blonde hair, blue eyes, and that is the egg that I'll use rather than my own. It may be an infertile person, et cetera.
Well, you're a bioethicist. I can only guess at what your position is on that sort of thing.
Well, I think it raises a lot of questions about eugenics. It raises questions about the understandings of egg donors, that is 18 to 21-year-olds who are often targeted by these companies. We don't fully know the full effects of donating eggs on women who donate, whether or not they will have trouble having children themselves, et cetera.
Human DNA is similar to other animals, like primates. Even fruit flies share an awful lot of genetic material with us. Do you see an ethical difference between patenting human DNA and fruit fly DNA?
Well, fruit flies don't get to complain about it, I think, is a major problem, a major difference. We can complain. It influences public health. We're more concerned about the health of our populace, our citizens, than we are about the health of fruit flies. Although, of course, if it's the health of bees and other animals, it can be important to us as well. But I think patenting genes is important because of what it does to us as individuals in our society.
Well, how far do we go with this? Many people are concerned about genetically modifying plants and the possible effects in the future to that process. In some cases, we're putting the genes of plants into fish and doing all sorts of playing all sorts of games. We can't clone legally, but we can do an awful lot of modifying. Are we at a point where we're playing playing God in a way that might be a little scary?
Well, I think so. I think we can, by the way, clone other species. We just can't clone ourselves. But there are people who clone house pets routinely. There are companies that will say if your Fido has died and you want another Fido, we'll clone Fido for you. And that's regularly done. We can't clone humans in the United States, but I'm sure at some point someone in some other country may do so.
So the law is going to have to follow the markets.
Yes.
What are biobanks?
Biobanks are an interesting phenomenon. If you walk into Vanderbilt University Hospital today or many other university hospitals, they will take a sample of your blood to sequence your whole genome so that they will soon have the complete genomes on as many patients as possible. This can help with personalized medicine so that if you walk in the door at some point, they can figure out what dose of what medicine to give to you. And it can help scientists figure out which patients have a particular disease and what their genes look like versus other patients' genes. But, of course, it also allows for the patentability of all these genes and the fact that there will be these databases that have identifiable information about you and might be able to be looked at by criminal justice folks and others.
So here we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of the complete mapping of the human genome, an incredible thing. And yet at the same time, we're having a conversation about all the possible problems that has opened up. Is this a Pandora's box?
I think so, but it's inevitable. And I think it's important to realize that there are wonderful things that have come about it as well. And I think that it should be a moment to pause and look at some of the social issues and decide, do we want to legislate in this area? Do we want more regulations? Should biobanks be able to do whatever they want? Should drug companies be able to collect as much genetic information on all of us as they want to do whatever they want with it, making as much money off it as possible? These are all questions I think we need to look at as a society to make sure we get as much benefit as we can and avoid as many risks as possible.
How much control do I have over what happens to my genetic information?
Unfortunately, probably not much in the future. Soon, I would predict in 10 years when you go to the doctor's office, the doctor will have your complete genome there on his or her computer and be able to say, I see you have the gene associated with Alzheimer's or breast cancer or anything else.
I can't wait. Robert L. Klitzman is professor of clinical psychiatry and the director of the Masters of Bioethics program at Columbia University. His book, Am I My Genes, is published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.